Lecture 18, the King James Version.
In the previous lecture, I sketched the initial stages of Englishing the Bible, beginning long before the Reformation with John Wycliffe, tracing the extraordinary accomplishments of William Tyndale, and then surveying some of the Bibles that began to spread among the British population. It was precisely this proliferation of Bibles, in fact, that made necessary the need for the next and really most important step in Englishing the Bible, the production of the King James Version. The authorized version of the Bible, or the King James Version, came about precisely as an attempt to standardize what was thought to be a chaotic state of affairs. The publication of the Great Bible under Cromwell had not stopped the process in the least, and in the late 16th and early 17th century, several English translations vied for primacy. The Geneva Bible had appeared in 1560, translated by William Whittington. It was the first English version to have numbered chapters and verses. More important, it had an introduction by John Calvin, and its many notes reflected a pro-Reformed and indeed an anti-Catholic bias. Here is an example of a translation reflecting an ideological position that I talked about in an earlier lecture. The term presbyter is translated not as priest, but as elder. The term ecclesia is translated not as church, but as congregation. So the translations reflect the ecclesial policy of Presbyterianism. This was a very popular Bible indeed. It went through 140 printings before 1640 and was used by James I as well as by the Puritan party in England. It was the Bible, moreover, of John Bunyan. John Bunyan did not quote the King James Bible. He used the Geneva Bible. And William Shakespeare, who used the Bible thoroughly, made countless allusions to the Bible. In fact, scholars have estimated that Shakespeare makes allusions to 42 books of the Bible, to the Gospel of Matthew 151 times, to the Psalms 137 times. And it was the Geneva Bible that Shakespeare quoted. This is the Bible that's sometimes referred to popularly as the Breeches Bible because of its translation of Genesis 3:7. When Adam and Eve discover that they are naked after their transgression, the Geneva Bible translates that they made themselves breeches. I'm not entirely certain that the King James Version, they made themselves aprons, is that much more intelligible. This was, in short, both a popular and a powerful version of the Bible. And for some in the English church, it appealed to the wrong kind of Protestant, especially the Puritans. The Puritans, you will recall, advanced a much more radical form of Reformation than the one comfortable for the clerics of the Church of England. In fact, Elizabeth I, who became queen in 1558, authorized a version called the Bishop's Bible, precisely to counter the influence of the Geneva Bible and to soothe ecclesiastical waters. It was published in 1568, and it retained the traditional ecclesiastical terms. Presbyter meant priest, ecclesia meant church. But it was less literarily impressive than the Geneva Bible and far less popular. It enjoyed only 20 reprints before 1606. Meanwhile, Gregory Martin and Richard Bristow, Catholic scholars in exile in Reims, produced a New Testament in 1582 with a distinctly Catholic preface. So their preface countered the position taken by the Reformation Party. The translation of the New Testament is from the Vulgate, but it takes the Greek into account. In 1610, Catholic scholars on the continent published the Old Testament in the city of Douai. So this version of the Catholic English Bible, translated from the Vulgate, is known as the Douai-Rheims Bible. It was used by English-speaking Catholics for centuries. It was revised by Richard Challoner in the 18th century, 1749 to 1752, and then was not revised again until 1941 with the Confraternity of Christian Doctrine version. For some conservative Roman Catholic readers today, the Douai-Rheims or the Chancellor version of the Bible is preferred to more contemporary translations in the same way that the King James version is favored by many conservative Protestants. So we have all of these competing Bibles, not only the ones that were produced earlier, the Coverdale, the Matthew's Bible, the Great Bible, but now the Geneva Bible, the Bishop's Bible, the Douai-Rheims Bible, all of them competing and representing, remember, different ecclesial and ideological positions. Are they for the Reform? Are they for Catholicism? Or what? So similar to the way in which Pope Damasus I in 382 assigned St. Jerome the task of revising existing Latin versions into the Vulgate, so King James authorized a version that could compete successfully with others and, it was to be hoped, supplant other English versions of the Bible. Now, the process by which the King James Version was produced was very official indeed, very elaborate. It wasn't a quick, spontaneous translation carried out by an individual. In fact, its program of translation is itself noteworthy and sets precedent for many other translation projects, including revisions of the King James Version. It was at a Hampton Court conference in 1604 that King James I responded to a petition made by bishops for a new translation that was needed because of the inadequacy, they said, it may have also been the popularity, of earlier translations. The first thing the conference did was set out a table of principles to guide the translation. And these make it clear that it was to be a conservative translation. For example, the first five principles enunciated by this conference were that the ordinary Bible read in the church, commonly called the Bishop's Bible, was to be followed as closely as possible, except where the truth of the original demanded something else. The names of all of the prophets and holy writers and other proper names in the Bible would be retained as they were vulgarly used, that is to say, popularly used. The old ecclesiastical terms were to be kept. So the word church is not to be translated as congregation in this version. And if a word has what they call divers significations or possibly different meanings, the one that had been most commonly in use in the tradition was to be employed. And the translators were not to mess around with chapters or verses and so forth. Everything was to be kept as much as possible as it was. It was a translation that was intended to be conservative. It was also meant to be minimal. No marginal notes were to be affixed. The only notes added were to be slight marginal ones to explain the Hebrew and Greek when the translation itself couldn't do it. The King James Version followed the practice of adding in italics or brackets words that were not absolutely found in the original, but when that did not suffice, then footnotes could be added simply to explain what the translation was about. But this was to be kept minimal, as were cross-references to be kept minimal. Another thing that this translation was intended to be was deeply collaborative. The principles that were laid out said that these 54 scholars that were taken from Oxford and Cambridge and Westminster and formed into six teams were each assigned chapters or sections of the text to translate. And so each person of each company was to undertake the translation first, then enter into conversation with other people who were translating that particular section. So it was to be collaborative from the ground up. And then each company should send what they have agreed upon to the other companies to get their review of the process. If disagreements arose at that level, they should then submit them to a general meeting of the scholars to decide the issue. If that failed, then they should consult somebody who had particular authority and expertise to check on the translation. And finally, the bishops of every region were to admonish their clergy and rouse up any experts that might be in their area to contribute their suggestions to the translation. So this was an extraordinarily collaborative, wide-ranging exercise in scholarship in the service of the church. So the translations then went forward, and this initial period took about 4 years of getting all of these sections translated. And then in 1609, a review panel of three scholars, who obviously had enormous authority, went over the preliminary work of the six teams. Now, the translation of the King James Version had as its basis the Masoretic text of the Old Testament and the Textus Receptus of the New Testament. We've talked about the Textus Receptus several times earlier. It's the Erasmus text of 1516, the text of the Complutensian Polyglot, and then that had been revised by Theodore Beza. But it also made use of earlier translations. The principles say these translations are to be used when they agree better with the text, that is of the Hebrew or Greek, than the Bishop's Bible, Tyndale's, Matthew's, Coverdale's, Whitchurch's, and Geneva. So they consulted other translations as well. The translators themselves, in their preface, declare that they were very aware of these earlier translations and wanted to respect them. Truly good Christian reader, they say. We never thought from the beginning that we should need to make a new translation, nor to make of a bad one a good one, but to make a good one better, or out of many good ones, one principal good one, not justly to be accepted against, that hath been our endeavor. And they go on to say, we are so far off from condemning any of their labors that travailed before us in this kind, either in this land or over the sea, either in King Henry's time or King Edward's or Queen Elizabeth's of every renowned memory, that we acknowledge them to have been raised up of God for the building and furnishing of his church, and that they deserve to be had of us and of posterity in everlasting remembrance. So they viewed their work as one of revision rather than one of absolute originality. And in fact, about 80% of the New Testament agrees with Tyndale. It is fundamentally Tyndale's translation that makes its way through the New Testament. The translation is, as I've mentioned, fairly literal, with words not found but implied by the original, marked in most printings by square brackets or italics. The Authorized Version, with Old Testament, Apocrypha, New Testament, was published by Robert Barker in 1611. It went through five editions, with minor revisions made in each of those editions, and it is the 1769 version by a scholar named Benjamin Blaney that has come to be the most commonly used. One might ask whether the King James Bible contained the famous red letter markings of the words of Jesus, because one can scarcely find a King James Bible these days that lack the red letter markings for the sayings of Jesus. This is a much later edition. An American editor of the Christian Herald magazine, Louis Klopsch, decided this would be a wonderful idea to add the red letters, and they were added to a publication of the New Testament, the King James Version, in 1899 and in an edition of the entire Bible in 1901. Now, the Authorized Version became the Bible for generations of English-speaking people in England and in other English-speaking territories and colonies, including America. The merit of the translation has often been noted. For example, Alexander Geddes, who died in 1802, who was a Roman Catholic priest and himself a translator, had this to say: "The highest eulogiums have been made on the translation of James I, both by our own writers and by foreigners, and indeed, if accuracy, fidelity, and the strictest attention to the letter of the text be supposed to constitute the qualities of an excellent version, this, of all versions, must in general be accounted to be the most excellent. Every sentence, every word, every syllable, every letter and point seem to have been weighed with the nicest exactitude, and expressed either in the text or the margin with the greatest precision." Thus the praise of Alexander Geddes. And two great British scholars, Westcott and Hort, themselves editors of a Greek edition of the New Testament, add their praise: "From the middle of the 17th century, the King's Bible has been the acknowledged Bible of the English-speaking nations throughout the world, simply because it is the best. A revision which embodies the ripe fruits of nearly a century of labor and appealed to the instincts of a great Christian people, gained by its own internal character a vital authority which could never have been secured by any edict of sovereign rulers." The argument here is that the King James Version succeeded not because it was authorized, but because it was simply a splendid translation, superior to those that had been undertaken previously. There is no question that it is a splendid translation. Its combination of simplicity, grace, and power are obvious when familiar passages are read. John 1:1-5, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by Him, and without Him was not made anything made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men, and the light shineth in darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not." Or John 3:16, a verse well known to everybody who's ever attended a ball game: "For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in Him should not perish, but have everlasting life." Or finally, from Matthew 16:13-18, "When Jesus came unto the coasts of Caesarea Philippi, He asked His disciples, saying, Whom do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? And they said, Some say that thou art John the Baptist, some Elias, and others Jeremias, or one of the prophets. He saith unto them, But whom say ye that I am? And Simon Peter answered and said, Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered and said unto them, Blessed art thou, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto thee, but my Father which is in heaven. And I say also unto thee that thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." It's lovely. One simply enjoys reading it because of the beauty of its English prose. It must be said, however, that it is not necessarily in every single verse superior to every other English translation, even back in the 16th century. For example, one can compare it to the Geneva translation on specific verses and see that the Geneva translation could be argued was superior. An example is Genesis 28:27, where the King James Bible has, "And it came to pass in the time of her travail that, behold, twins were in her womb. And it came to pass when she travailed that the one put out his hand." And it came to pass, and it came to pass. Very much Bible talk, but not necessarily as crisp and clean as the Geneva translation, which has simply, "Now when the time was come that she should be delivered, behold, there were twins in her womb. And when she was in travail, the one put out his hand. Simpler, cleaner, a superior translation to the wordier version of the King James. The supposed influence of the King James Version on English literature can also be overstated. In a famous essay, C.S. Lewis talks about how really very difficult it is to actually trace whether it is the King James Version which is having an influence on the English language or just all of the other versions that were around, just Bible language itself. Remember, 80% of the King James Version turns out to be Tyndale's version. So one might say that it was Tyndale who had the greatest influence on subsequent literature. So it is clear that John Milton and John Dryden were deeply influenced by the King James Bible, make allusions to specific passages in the King James Bible that they read there. But as I've mentioned, Bunyan and Shakespeare and John Donne all used the Geneva Bible. So that also can be greatly overstated. Some of its influence, as I've suggested, may have come from its being authorized, but I think basically it was the excellence. The Geneva Bible had its last reprinting after so many before in 1644, and the King James made its way as the Bible for English-speaking people. Let's talk a little bit about the deficiencies of the King James Bible, having stated, I think, fulsomely enough, its virtues. The deficiencies of the King James Version are not due to its translators, but due to other factors. For the 16th century, everything that we've said about the King James Version can stand. It is the best of all the translations then. There are three basic things, however, that make the King James Version less than adequate today. The first is the textual basis of the King James is inadequate when measured by the developed science of text criticism of the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. That will be a subsequent lecture on the development of text criticism of the Bible. The King James Version, as I've mentioned, uses the Textus Receptus of Erasma, of the Complutensian Polyglot, and of Theodore Beza. This text, for example, of the Greek New Testament is based on very few manuscripts, and they tend to be recent manuscripts, that is, from the 14th through the 10th century. By comparison, scholars over the last 300 years have gathered together well over 5,000 manuscripts of the New Testament, many of them dating from the 4th, 5th, 3rd, and 2nd centuries. So there, it is possible to have a much better Greek basis than that translated by the King James translators. Secondly, the knowledge of the languages of Hebrew and Greek have advanced immeasurably because of the intense scholarship of the past 400 years. The knowledge of Hebrew at Cambridge and Oxford in the 16th century was basically derived from the Bible itself and possibly in conversation with rabbinic scholars. Over the past 400 years, the knowledge of Hebrew has grown tremendously, largely because of the discovery of cognate languages like Hittite and Ugaritic and others that enable a better understanding of Hebrew vocabulary and syntax. And the same thing can be said of Greek. I will develop these points in subsequent lectures. Most of all, however, the English language itself has changed dramatically, so that a translation that was simple and direct in the 16th century can appear obsolete and even unintelligible in the 21st century. Now, this is a fact which is often hidden from us because of the constant use of the King James Bible, so that we're seldom asked to really translate what we've just read in a translation. What does that really mean? Can you parse that sentence? So, for example, Matthew 5:26, "Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence till thou hast paid the uttermost farthing." Now, this is a short sentence of 20 words, but 10 of these words are not in contemporary English usage. We don't speak of uttermost. We don't know what a farthing is. We don't say thence. And certainly we don't use the word verily. So it's that shift in the meaning of English which makes a big difference. Or to take something almost at random, 2 Corinthians 9:4, Paul says to the Corinthians, "Lest haply, if they of Macedonia come with me and find you unprepared, that we say not ye, should be ashamed in this same confident boasting." Oh, there's lots of difficulties here. Among other things, when I said haply, H-A-P-L-Y, you may have heard happily, which it certainly is not. So lest is also a word that I think we would be challenged to say exactly what it means. Lest haply. This kind of thing means that we're reading an English which is no longer our own language. Let me give one final example, which is telling on several counts. 1 Timothy 1:4-6. "Neither give heed," says Paul to Timothy, "to fables and endless genealogies, which minister questions, rather than godly edifying, which is faith. Now the end of the commandment is charity out of a pure heart, and of a good conscience, and of faith unfeigned, from which some, having swerved, have turned aside into vain jangling." Now I submit to you that vain jangling is a wonderful phrase, as is faith unfeigned. But if we were to ask what exactly vain jangling means in our contemporary parlance, we might have a difficult time. Furthermore, we do not use the word charity any longer for love. For us, charity has the sense of benevolence and giving financially and so forth. And what Paul is using is the word agape, which means love, this attitude of self-donation to others. Furthermore, the phrase "which minister questions" uses the word "minister" in a manner which is totally foreign to the way in which we speak of ministering. We simply do not use the term in that fashion. The Greek would have "give rise to questions." Finally, the phrase "godly edifying" may make good church talk, but what it actually means is fairly obscure. Edification is a fairly weak word in English. So godly edifying is not only problematic at the level of translation, but here I come back to an earlier point. That phrase is also based on a Greek text which represents the least likely Greek text for that passage. In other words, most good Greek manuscripts have oikonomia theou, which could be translated as something like God's way of ordering things, rather than oikodomein theou, godly edifying. So it is not simply the translation, but also the Greek and Hebrew text, and also the change in our understanding of those languages, which make the King James Version today a marvelous monument of 16th century learning. A variety of revisions and improvements were made to the King James Version by folks who were deeply dedicated to it, but saw these limitations. Over the past 100 years in particular, there has been the American Standard Version, the Revised Standard Version, the New Revised Standard Version, the New King James Version, all basically following the lead of the English that had so brilliantly been rendered by William Tyndale and so marvelously monumentalized by the King James Version.